It is learned this evening that just before the rapid sequence of events began yesterday in Vienna, which led to the appointment early this morning of Seyss Inquart to the Austrian Chancellorship, a special aeroplane arrived in Bonn from Berlin, carrying a personal letter from Herr Hitler to Signor Mussolini. Today at midday, Austrians and Germans tuned in on their radios to hear Minister Goebbels read a special proclamation by Herr Hitler to all German-speaking people, justifying his move in sending troops into Austria at the bid of Austria's new pro-Nazi premier, Dr. Seyss Inquart. In this proclamation, Herr Hitler, after having recapitulated in passionate terms the history of his attempts to induce the Austrian government, headed by Herr Schuschnigg, to adopt a more lenient attitude towards pro-Nazi Austrians, said, "I have finally decided to place at the disposal of the millions of Germans in Austria the help of the Reich. Since this morning, armed forces of Germany are marching beyond the boundaries of German Austria. These forces, called in by the new National Socialist Vienna government, will guarantee the possibility to the Austrian people to shape its future through a true plebiscite in the shortest possible time. Behind these armed formations marches the will of the whole German nation. I myself, as leader and chancellor of the German people, will be happy to place my foot as a German and as a free citizen in that land which is also my fatherland. The world must convince itself," ends the Führer's proclamation, "that the German people of Austria are now living hours of the deepest joy. They see in their brothers who have arrived to help them the saviors in their hour of need." The proclamation ends with these significant words: "Hurrah for the Nationalist Socialist German Reich. Hurrah for German National Socialist Austria." The first official inkling that a change was impending in the Austrian setup came yesterday when the Vienna radio laconically broadcast the following communique: "The Chancellor and leader of the Popular Front has decided to postpone the plebiscite due on Sunday. Further communications will follow." This statement implied that the Chancellor's policies that were to have received tomorrow the sanction of the Austrian nation were, to say the least, wavering. Confirmation of this came at 7:30, when Chancellor Schuschnigg himself stepped up to a microphone and announced his resignation. He then spoke, "Austrian women and men, this day has placed us before a grave situation. The government of the Reich, of the German Reich, has sent to our federal president an ultimatum according to which the federal president must name Chancellor a man of their designation and constitute a cabinet in compliance with the proposals of the German government, otherwise German troops will enter Austria. I state before the world," went on Herr Schuschnigg, "that the news according to which riots have broken out with lots of bloodshed, without the government being in a position to control the situation, is false from A to Z. The federal president charges me to tell you that we are bowing before violence. As we do not intend, even in this climatic hour, to spill German blood, we have ordered our army to draw back without substantial resistance in case the invasion should take place and to await the decisions of the next few hours. Thus," ended Herr Schuschnigg, "I take leave from the Austrian people with this wish. May God protect Austria." The statements contained in Herr Schuschnigg's speech were officially denied today in Berlin. Herr Schuschnigg's pronouncement was followed a little later by an address of incoming Chancellor Seyss Inquart, who also broadcast his words over the radio. He said, "Men and women of Austria, comrades of the German people, in view of the happenings of today and of those towards which we are moving, I declare that I remain at my post and consider myself responsible for the order and tranquility of the country. I invite everyone to maintain the same order and tranquility. The events of the next few hours and discipline call for discipline. Any demonstration must be kept within reasonable bounds. I particularly appeal to the Austrian National Socialists to preserve order and induce their comrades to act in this sense. I count on them to uphold the executive power and to keep ready for any emergency. I remind you also that any resistance against an eventual advance of the German army is out of the question. I invite you to unite and help us to face a happy future." The actual appointment of Dr. Seyss Inquart to the chancellorship did not come until 1:30 this morning, when the great windows of the balcony of the Chancellery were thrown open and a new cabinet list was read to the people amongst much applause. This list included, besides Seyss Inquart, Dr. Horstenau as Vice-Chancellor, Dr. Wolf for Foreign Affairs, Dr. Huber, Göring's brother-in-law, for Justice. This afternoon at 3:45, a 5 truckloads of German soldiers, led by a lieutenant colonel, reached the Brennero Pass on the Italo-Austrian frontier. Their commander immediately contacted the political and military local authorities. The German officer spoke in Italian to the Italian commander of the Brennero garrison, saying, "I bring to you the greetings of the German nation and the expression of German admiration for your leader." The Italian commander answered, thanking the German colonel and expressing words of sympathy for Germany and the Führer. The meeting developed along lines of cordial comradeship. After 2 hours, the German contingent left for Innsbruck, leaving behind them a non-commissioned officer with a few soldiers for police work. From London, in the meanwhile, we learn that following a cabinet meeting, an official communique has been issued which says that the British government considers the action undertaken by the German government with regard to Austria cannot but reflect on Anglo-German relations and on the sense of security in Europe. The British government is maintaining close contact with the French government and is following with unabated interest the developments of the situation. Another message tells us that Czechoslovakia and Hungary have closed their frontiers with Austria. At the same time, Romania has closed her frontiers with Yugoslavia, Hungary and Czechoslovakia to stop Austrian refugee Jews from seeking harbour in Romania. Herr Hitler this evening gave an address at Linz in Upper Austria. Rome. In a leading article on the front page of Giornale Italia, Signor Virginio Gaida this evening faces squarely the latest Austrian developments under the title Germany and Austria, the Fatal Truth. After tracing the past events and changes which have led up to the current move, Signor Virginio Gaida writes, "The gaze of foreigners turns to Italy, as if awaiting some extraordinary reaction. In Italy, however," Mr. Gaida states, "there can be no perturbing reaction. The Italian position is perfectly clear and precise. Italy has placed no obstacles and intends to place no obstacles in the path of a natural stage of German national history." This Italian attitude of national respect, of international correctness, and of realism has been in evidence for some time. On March the 1st, 1937, for instance, confronted with the surprise simulated in some foreign quarters at Italy's position in regard to the injudicious agitation for the Habsburg restoration in Austria, we wrote, "The fascist government will certainly not be the one to undervalue great historic national traditions." We excluded at that time that the Rome-Berlin axis could be split by any Austrian problem and that Italy should be eternally and exclusively nailed to the Brennero Pass. "On the 18th of last February," continues Dr. Gaida, "we likewise wrote, Italy observes a policy of respect for the national rights of all peoples and also for the current historical realities. It would be more than folly, it would be cruel, to try and spur 7 million Austrians against 66 million Germans, and especially on a question which is based on national unity. At that time, we likewise," continues Mr. Gaida, "gave the lie to all the fabulous news circulated in this regard, and we stated that Chancellor Schuschnigg had never, on the question of his relations with Germany, asked for anything from Italy, and had limited himself to informing the Italian government of the agreement reached." Signor Gaida concludes, "This notable chapter of European history must be considered in the light of historic fatalities. A spirit of calm reflection must replace that other spirit, already so abundantly displayed elsewhere, of sterile polemics and useless protests." Spain. The overwhelming advance of General Franco's army in the Montalban-Belchite sector continues, and its spearhead has now reached a point fully 30 miles forward from where the advance started. 32 towns and villages have thus been freed from the red yoke, while over 5,000 red militiamen have been captured in a startling series of rapid encircling moves which promise to make the current battle one of the most decisive of the whole civil war. Among the principal towns which are now flying the red and gold flag of New Spain are Alarcón and Oriente. The nationalist advance is being conducted along three main axes. The southern one points on Montalbán. The center curves upward along the Martín River past Oriente. The third, which took Belchite in its stride 2 days ago, is now headed for the town of Azaíla, just south of the big bend in the Ebro River. Actual red casualties on the field are hard to figure as Franco's shock troops sweep forward relentlessly, leaving behind them entire battlefields strewn with corpses. Approximate calculations give the number of red losses, aside from the 5,000 prisoners mentioned, at over 8,000 fallen. Hard fighting is also reported near Guadalajara, a point far distant from the actual scene of the Aragon advance. Here too, the Marxist front has been broken in two spots, and news from other sectors also points to a general wavering of the whole far-flung red defense system, which runs from the Pyrenees to Almeria in the southern Mediterranean. Moscow. The last session of the monstrous Moscow trial opened this morning at 11 and was given over exclusively to hearing the 21 prisoners in the dock recite for the last time the prearranged lines, telling of the incredible crimes that they are supposed to have committed. Sentence on the 21 men is expected to be passed by Judge Ulrich in the early hours of tomorrow morning. This sentence, which has presumably been dictated by Stalin long ago, is expected to follow closely the request laid down yesterday by Prosecutor Vyshinsky when he roared for the life of 19 of the 21 accused. More drama is contained in other reports issuing from censor-clogged Russia, according to which Marshal Blücher, commander of the whole Eastern Soviet Army, has finally met with the fate of his many colleagues and landed in prison. Of Marshal Budyeni, commander of the Moscow garrison, is also given. Addis Ababa. To mark the achieved pacification of Ethiopia, 900 natives concentrated at Danane in Somaliland have been set free in a formal ceremony at which the governor of Addis Ababa, His Excellency Signor Kaniero Medici, was present. The governor first spoke to the natives, explaining to them the significance of the viceroy's act of clemency. He was followed by the Abuna Abraham, head of the Coptic Ethiopian Church, who voiced the gratitude of the men benefiting from amnesty. Among the many indications pointing to a general appeasement in the Gojam province, we learn also from Addis Ababa today that Dejazmak Alieu Mashesha has placed himself and his men at the disposal of the Italian command. Rome. On the 24th of May, another exhibition illustrating the developments of New Italy will be opened in the Circo Massimo, or Circus Maximus area, with a textile show achieved such outstanding success during the past autumn and winter. The plans for the new exhibition, which will feature the activities of the National Fascist Leisure Hour Organization, or Opera Nazionale Dopo Lavoro, as it is called in Italian, have been approved by the Duce. The coming exhibition, which will remain open for 3 months, or in other words, until the 31st of August, is expected to utilize some of the standard pavilions which have been built in this suggestive locality between the Aventine and the Palatine Hills. A full new crop of pavilions will also be built to accommodate the special needs of the Leisure Hour Organization display. The new constructions include a whole amphitheater capable of accommodating 3,000 spectators. This will be surmounted by a crystal tower, which will be splendidly illuminated at night. The exhibition will also provide its visitors with an open-air swimming pool and many other attractions. In the center of the ground, a typical Italian village will be built. In this, there will be opened a series of kitchens attached to small restaurants, each featuring the cooking of some different region in Italy. That is the end of our news bulletin. And we now close down our English transmission.
We present John Steele, European representative of the Mutual Network, in another of his transatlantic broadcasts. These broadcasts from London, England, are presented on alternate Saturday nights at this time. And on them, Mr. Steele, who is a veteran foreign news correspondent and a journalist of more than 20 years' experience, discusses international affairs with particular emphasis on the political and economic situation in European countries. Mr. Steele's keen insight into European conditions makes these news broadcasts of international importance. We now take you to London, England.
Good evening. Hitler has swallowed Austria. It matters not what camouflage of separate government may be maintained, and it is not likely that Hitler will be too considerate about that. Austria is today just as much a part of the German Reich as Prussia or Bavaria, and Hitler may congratulate himself on having achieved his second great objective, the Anschluss, or union of his native Austria with his adopted Germany. Events moved swiftly on Friday, once he had determined to act. You are already familiar with the moves on the board. The series of ultimatums which ended in the acceptance by President Miklas under duress, with German troops already marching into his country, of Dr. von Schuschnigg's resignation as Chancellor, and the appointment of Dr. von Seyss-Inquart, Hitler's nominee, whose first act after appointing a complete Nazi cabinet was to appeal to Hitler to send German troops to maintain order in Austria. This was swiftly followed by the arrival in Vienna of Rudolf Hess, Hitler's number two man, to take charge, and today Hitler himself has arrived. It is worthwhile going back a bit to review the events leading up to this coup, which may change the whole face of Europe. It all began with the Saint-Germain Treaty in 1919. All of Austria was then anxious to join up with Germany, but the Allies, led by France, which was determined to crush Germany, refused to allow it. Today, or perhaps it would be better to say yesterday, a majority, not very large perhaps, of the Austrians wanted to remain independent. Tomorrow, I'm not so sure what the majority would say. If there was a free vote, I think it would be about 50-50, or perhaps there might be a slight majority in favor of the Anschluss. You all know what happened a few weeks ago when Hitler summoned Schuschnigg to visit him at Berchtesgaden and gave him his orders about the gradual Nazification of Austria. Schuschnigg, feeling that he had no friends in Europe on whom he could rely, yielded, but when he got back to Vienna, he found Austrian morale better than he had expected and his backbone stiffened. Then I think he overplayed his hand. He ordered a plebiscite for tomorrow on the single question, are you in favor of a free and independent Austria? The answer must be yes or no. Now that would have been a trick ballot. Even Nazis might have felt that they could not answer no. And as the question was framed, Schuschnigg was sure of a yes majority. We have seen a few of these trick ballots, both official and unofficial, in Europe recently, and no one attaches a great deal of importance to them. But Hitler now has announced that he will hold a plebiscite on the question of an immediate Anschluss. The result is a foregone conclusion. Anyhow, Schuschnigg gave Hitler his chance. Declaring that it was an unfair ballot, he demanded that it be postponed, threatening force if Schuschnigg refused. Under duress, Schuschnigg consented. Then, in quick time, followed an order from Berlin that Schuschnigg should resign, accompanied by the movement of German troops across the frontier. Schuschnigg at first refused, and an ultimatum with a three-hour limit followed. Schuschnigg yielded, but President Miklas refused to accept his resignation. Then he too yielded to the threat of force and appointed Seyss-Inquart. What will happen next? It is difficult at the moment to say. France and Britain have protested and declared that they take a grand view of the situation. That is one of those happy diplomatic phrases which may mean a lot or nothing at all. I don't think in this case it means much. By that I mean that I don't think that either Britain or France will go to war with Germany to save Austria. Germany promptly rejected the protest. Much depends on what happens in Rome. There the cabinet is meeting and the strictest control has been exercised over the press. We know that Mussolini cannot like what has happened. He has posed as the protector of Austria's independence. And this has not been from any love of freedom, but for the very concrete reason that he does not like the idea of a strong Germany on the Brenner Pass, controlling the entrance to the Italian plain, where German troops have already arrived. He preferred to have Austria as a weak buffer state between him and his great and good friend Hitler. That in some measure explains his desire to make a bargain with Britain, which would have strengthened his hand. He will probably be all the more anxious to do so now. In France, the effect has been instantaneous. France was just going through another domestic political crisis. The Chautemps government had fallen on domestic issues, and we all thought that we were in for another of those periods of horse trading in which in France had become so familiar before a new government could be found. But last night, M. Blum, the socialist leader, announced that he would succeed in forming a government of national union and that all domestic differences would be sunk in face of the emergency. Tonight, the question on everyone's lips is, will Czechoslovakia come next? Hitler has made no more secret of his determination to absorb the Germans in the northwest corner of Czechoslovakia than he did of his intention to gobble Austria. Here, however, he is faced with Czechoslovakia's definite military alliances with France and with Russia, which Britain in turn is linked up through her association with France. But will her allies fight for Czechoslovakia? Russia, it seems to me, is out of the picture at the moment. She is too deeply disorganized at home, and she has Japan to think of. France could not fight alone, and I doubt that British statesmen, even if they wanted to do so, could get British boys to die for poor little Czechoslovakia, as they died 24 years ago for poor little Belgium. Perhaps Hitler may be bought off. I don't think that today he can be fought off. Tonight, Germany has assured Czechoslovakia that she has no hostile intentions, but such assurances are like pie crust, made to be broken. In London, there is great coming and going among diplomats, and the cabinet is standing by for any emergency, but no one suggests anything practical to save Austria. Meantime, Britain has been hard at work trying to remove some of the most obvious of the other maladjustments. The official conversations with Italy have begun. The Earl of Perth, British ambassador in Rome, has been in London and received his instructions, and is now in regular conference with Count Ciano, Mussolini's son-in-law and foreign minister. You may wonder who the Earl of Perth is, for you never heard of him as a diplomat until recently. As a matter of fact, you have heard a good deal about him for a long time. For as Sir Eric Drummond, he was, before he succeeded to his brother's title a few months ago, and as Secretary General of the League of Nations, he was one of the best-known diplomats in Europe. This change of name due to succession to a title is one of the puzzles of the English system, which many of other nations fail to understand. For instance, Lord Halifax, the present British Foreign Secretary, is far better known abroad as Lord Irwin, under which title he was a great Viceroy of India. And before that, he had a career in England as a most successful Minister of Education, under the name of the Honorable Edward Wood. While Lord Perth was talking with Count Ciano, Lord Halifax had opened conversations with Hermann Ribbentrop, the German Foreign Minister, who returned this week to London to say goodbye to the friends he had made as ambassador at the Court of St. James. And tonight he is still here. It is too early yet to say what the result of these conversations will be, but it is possible to see emerging from the preliminary talks a rough sketch of what the Italians and Germans want. First of all, Mussolini, of course, wants his Abyssinian conquest recognized. That will be easy. No one is going to bother any more about Abyssinia, and the British, it is reported, have already offered to back a resolution at the next League meeting, releasing all members from any League obligations on this subject, and leaving them to decide individually what they want to do about it. Next, and more difficult, Mussolini wants a loan. He is really hard up, and he needs money to pay for the conquest of Abyssinia and to develop it. The sum of $125 million has been mentioned, but that is merely one guess, which may or may not be lucky. And let me say here that you must not think of such a loan as from one state to another. Britain will lend no government money to Italy. What she will do, if agreement is reached, is allow her bankers to float an Italian loan in London, if they're satisfied with the security. She may also let British exporters to Italy take advantage of the Export Credits Act, under which the British government, if satisfied with the commercial rating of the purchasers, guarantees a long credit. Other demands are naval parity in the Mediterranean. Just what is meant by that is not yet clear, but it is generally taken here that Italy wants her right recognized to have as many ships in the Mediterranean, which is the only part of the world where she needs a fleet, as France and Britain normally keep there. Hitler's demands were also being investigated, but the situation there may now be changed. First and foremost is the restoration of the old German colonies, or the acquisition of others at least as good. And he says that he will have no cow trading over this, meaning that he does not propose to give anything in return. He bases this attitude on the theory that the present holders have no just title. I am not going into a discussion of what constitutes a just title to colonies, which in every instance were first acquired by force. Work that out for yourselves. While Britain is thus speaking softly to the dictators, she is hard at work getting ready her big stick. In the armaments debate in Parliament this week, the Prime Minister spoke of this enormous, this almost terrifying power which Britain is building up, and declared that it already has had a sobering and steadying effect on the opinion of the world. Whether that is so or not, yesterday's events may probe. And what's more, Britain is willingly paying the bill. Mr. Chamberlain warned the Commons that the estimated cost of $7.5 billion announced a couple of months ago would be insufficient. How far it would be exceeded, he found it impossible to say yet. But he warned the House that the advance would be substantial. And the Commons never even winced. There was no complaint. The people of Britain want peace and have made up their minds that they are willing to pay a high insurance premium. Even the Labourites, who have a pacifist record, come to the method of expenditure, but did not attack the principle. In another direction, there is an interesting sign of the awakening of Britain to defence necessities. In the old days, the British regular soldier was almost a pariah. He was badly fed, badly paid, badly housed, and badly treated. Today, that type of man is no use to the army. In fact, he has largely disappeared from civil life, and now it is realized that soldiering in a modern mechanized army has become a skilled trade. And on Thursday, Mr. Horv Elisha, the very energetic war minister, announced a complete reorganization of the regular army. There are many features in this new deal, but not the least interesting is the announcement of very substantial increases in the soldiers' pay. Now, in addition to being well-fed, the army has just retained the head of Britain's greatest catering firm to supervise the soldiers' food. Well-clothed and well-housed, he is to be well-paid. The young soldier on joining will receive a little over $5 a week, which is pure pocket money, and his pay increases with service. If he is still a private and unmarried, he will attain about $8. If he is married, however, and has one child, he will be allowed to live out of barracks and will receive more than $16 a week with rations and clothing. And in addition to that, he can earn proficiency pay, which might amount to another $2 or so a week. The pay of non-commissioned officers is raised proportionately, and a new rank of warrant officer is created to encourage ambitious men to seek promotion. These rates compare favorably with what a man can earn in civil life, and he is guaranteed against unemployment for as long as he remains in the army. But there is no intention of building an immense conscript army. What Britain is after is a highly efficient, long-service army of professional soldiers, like the old Contentables, who stopped the first German rush at the beginning of the last war. I've been trying to tell you about the Anglo-Irish negotiations as they have gone along, because they are important not only to the great Irish race throughout the world, but because they should interest everyone who is desirous of world stability. Well, this week I can tell you they are going well. The trade agreement is almost certain. There may even be an arrangement on the defense of the Sister Islands. And, I hesitate to say it, for it seems too much to expect so soon, there is some hope of a softening of the British attitude on partition. I don't think partition will go just yet a while, but Prime Minister de Valera may be able to go back to Dublin with substantial hope that an effort will be made to bring the six counties to reason.
This concludes the talk by John Steele, who spoke to you from London, England. John Steele, veteran news correspondent, is the European representative of the Mutual Network. He brings to his discussion of world affairs an authority and insight which he has gained by his many years' experience as news gatherer in both Europe and America. The next broadcast by John Steele will be presented 2 weeks from tonight, Saturday, March 26th at 9 o'clock. This is the Mutual Broadcasting System.